It is such a privilege to be here tonight with this amazing group, and I am so proud to be a member of Veterans for Peace. We just feel within this group this powerful, beautiful energy and the potential of what we can accomplish together. Now, I'm sure you've all noticed we live in an interesting time. Wall Street excesses have collapsed the U.S. economy and brought down the world economy with it. The primary culprits walked away with huge amounts of money while millions have lost their jobs and their homes. This, of course, has been getting a lot of attention lately, but it isn't our only problem. We're fighting unnecessary and unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that are decimating our military establishment. Climate change is bringing massive weather disruptions that, along with the depletion of our soils and groundwater, threaten the world's food system. And we depend on an aging physical and economic infrastructure designed to run on cheap oil that is increasingly becoming very scarce. The good news is that we finally have a president who understands that these are actually problems that need serious attention. And this is a huge accomplishment. I want to note here, often when we talk about citizen action, people will note, well, look back to February 15th, 2003. We had the greatest peace demonstration the world has ever known. Estimates of 10 million to 30 million people on the streets all saying, no war, no war. And, of course, we failed. But a deeper look. I think there's a real connection between that demonstration and our election of Barack Obama as president. These are not unrelated events. In the end, I think we have won an enormous victory. This is a turning of the political tide nationally and globally. Now, one of the things we have to be clear on. We have a president in which we have a great deal of faith, but this is no time to sit back and wait for President Obama to fix the world all by himself. Getting out of this mess requires a total commitment of every person on the planet who has a moral conscience and a functioning mind. I assume that includes all of us here in this room. For those of us who believe there is a better way, this is in fact a truly exciting time to be alive. The old system is destroying itself to make way for the new. The time has come to make real the world of peace and justice for all, which most humans have dreamed of for millennia. It is the greatest creative challenge our species has ever faced, and it requires that we rediscover that which makes us truly human and reinvent our societies to nurture our human capacity to create, care, and cooperate rather than our capacity to dominate and destroy. President Obama has assumed the leadership of a nation weakened economically, morally, and militarily. It is a time to rebuild in ways that actualize the true founding ideals of liberty and justice on which our great country was founded. It is a moment that requires new leadership from all of us as we put aside outmoded assumptions and false values that have led our nation and our species to the brink of ruin. It requires that we break the silence to acknowledge the sins of our collective past even as we celebrate the possibilities of our collective future. It is a time to break the isolation that has separated us by race, by class, ethnic origin, and religion so that we may become a true national community within a larger planetary community of peoples and nations. It is a time when we face the reality that we either work together for the good of all or we perish together in collective violence. As veterans who have known war, we know that peace is more than the absence of war. True peace is community, sharing, and partnership. It's a world in which we each care for our neighbors as we care for ourselves. When Jesus was asked, "What is the greatest of all the commandments?" he replied, "Thou shalt love thy Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and with all thy strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Every major religion in the world has a similar teaching. As I understand it, God is the name we give to the eternal spirit of life. We are thus instructed to love life with all our being, and to love your neighbor, who is a manifestation of this loving spirit, as we love ourselves, because we are also manifestations of that spirit. I'm going to let you in on a stunning little secret. In 1992, I participated in the civil society portion of the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. It was a gathering of some 15,000 people representing the vast variety of humanity's races, religions, nationalities, and languages. Our discussion centered on defining the world we would create together. And out of our conversations emerged an articulation of our shared dream of a world in which people and nature live in dynamic, creative, cooperative, and balanced relationship. And what was so extraordinary out of that is out of all these differences, it turned out we all wanted the same thing. The Earth Charter, which is the product of a continuation of this conversation, calls it Earth Community, a community of life. Now, it's not actually so surprising when you think about it. Most every human wants to breathe clean air and drink clean water. We want tasty, nutritious food uncontaminated with toxins. We want our children to be healthy and happy. We want meaningful work, a living wage, and security in our old age. We want a say in the decisions our government makes. We want world peace. We want a vibrant, natural environment. It's all so basic, so simple. Yet we become so accustomed to cultures and institutions that reward and celebrate our human pathologies of individualism, greed, hubris, deceit, ruthless competition, and material excess that we have come to doubt even the possibility that we humans might have, as a species, the capacity to cooperate in the interests of a common good. We may even fail to notice that most people daily demonstrate our human capacity for caring, sharing, honesty, cooperation, compassion, peacemaking, service, and material sufficiency. Scientists who have used advanced imaging technology to study the brain function report that the healthy human brain is actually wired to reward our positive traits. Merely thinking about another person experiencing harm triggers the same reaction in our brain as that of a mother who sees distress in the face of her baby. Negative emotions suppress our immune system, increase our heart rate, and prepare us to fight or flee. Conversely, an act of cooperation and generosity triggers the brain's pleasure center to release the same hormone released when we eat chocolate or engage in good sex. Think about really getting it on here with all this cooperation, compassion, caring. In addition to producing a sense of bliss, cooperation, and generosity, we benefit our health by boosting our immune system, reducing our heart rate, and preparing us to approach and soothe. Now, these findings are totally consistent with the pleasure that most of us feel when we have the opportunity to participate in an effective team, or when we have the opportunity to extend help and caring to some other being. Now, it's entirely logical. If our brains were not wired for life and community, our species would have expired long ago. We have an instinctual desire to protect the group, including its weakest and most vulnerable members, our children. Caring, cooperation, and service are both the healthy norm, and they are wonderful health tonics. Behavior contrary to this positive norm is actually an indicator of serious social and psychological dysfunction. Individualistic violence, greed, and destruction and disregard of others are all clearly within our means, but they are pathologies. They are not our inherent nature. It is our true nature to love, cooperate, and create. Are you with me?
Yes.
Yeah. So here's the stunning little secret. The world we must now create, if we are to survive as a species, is the world we want, the world our brains are wired to create, and the world that the religious prophets down through the ages have sought to inspire us to bring into being. Among other things, it will require replacing the culture and institutions of an economy devoted to the service of money with the culture and institutions of an economy devoted to the service of life. Very simple. War is an outmoded institution that serves no beneficial purpose other than to enrich the unscrupulous. And it has become an act of global scale collective suicide. It is our time to create a world of peace, to turn our swords into plowshares and our spears into sickles, so that one nation shall no longer lift its sword against the life of another. It is time to convert our economies from war to peace, to devote every resource at our command to the revitalization rather than the destruction of life. We must create societies that affirm and celebrate the love that is life. This is our work. It is a great work. Are you with me? Yeah! Momentum is building on various fronts, some rather surprising. For example, the call by establishment insiders like George Shultz, who was U.S. Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan, to dismantle all the world's nuclear weapons. That seems like a good idea. Another is the emergent social movement calling all the world's parliaments to adopt the principle of Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. In the official translation, this article reads, "Aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. In order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized." In May 1999, 6,000 global citizens gathered in The Hague for what at that time was the largest peace conference in history and issued the Hague Appeal for Peace. Among other measures, they recommended every parliament shall adopt a resolution prohibiting their government from going to war like the Japanese Article 9. Another good idea. Are you with me? Here in the United States, our military expenditures account for more than half of U.S. federal discretionary budget and account for roughly half of the world's military expenditures. We suggest that we are among the best position of nations to take the lead in renouncing war as an instrument of national policy and dismantling the means of conducting war. Now here's the message that we need to be communicating. The greatest threats to U.S. security come not from any foreign army. They come from weather chaos, oil dependence, disruption of food supplies, water scarcity, domestic gun violence, and as demonstrated most recently, from financial speculators, zombie banks, and hedge funds. The greatest military threat to our domestic security is from a handful of terrorists armed primarily with a willingness to die for their cause. We face a greater danger from our own children brandishing guns in our schools than from any opposing army. Such threats share in common the simple fact that even the world's mightiest military force offers no protection from any of the real threats to our security. The solutions depend on the strength of our families and our communities, which are weakened, not strengthened, by our military budget. Are you with me?
Yes.
Yeah. Public awareness of the costly failure of our military misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan have created a moment of opportunity for the U.S. peace movement to build a popular political support for a security policy that renounces war as an instrument of foreign policy and sets forth a plan to, one, dismantle the obsolete machinery that is depleting our national treasure. Two, convert our war economy of the past to a green economy of the future. Three, mobilize our human and material resources to address the real threats to our security. And four, work with the other nations of the world to do the same. This is the moment. It is an opportunity to at once increase our security, improve the quality of our lives, and regain a position of principled global leadership. Are you with me?
Yes.
So let's get down to the practical nitty-gritty and talk about what we actually need to do. Starting with a topic that seems to be much on people's minds of late. Money. Money. The most mysterious of human inventions, a magical number of no meaning or existence outside the human mind, that has displaced life as our object of sacred veneration and become the ultimate arbiter of human priorities. Money allows some to live in grand opulence in the midst of scarcity. Lack of it confines others to death by starvation in the midst of plenty. Money has largely displaced mutual caring as the primary currency mediating our access to the essentials of daily existence. The result is a loss of a sense of meaning and of the relationships of caring families and communities essential to true health, happiness, and security. The related distortion of our priorities legitimates the destruction of people and nature for short-term profit. And it legitimates a system of global rule by those who control the creation and allocation of money solely for personal gain. It is also the foundation for war. War, in a competition to secure access to cheaper resources, to fuel wasteful consumption, to drive corporate profits, serves money. Peace serves life. To have true peace, we must take stock of all our available resources and assure that each and every one is used responsibly and sustainably to meet the needs of all people and of all living beings, because our lives ultimately depend on one another. Restoring local self-reliance and caring relationships while reducing environmentally destructive consumption and automobile dependence all strengthen the ties of family and community, reduce the rationale for war, strengthen the power of life, and reduce the power of money. Are you with me?
Yes.
Most all of the distorted priorities of our society can be traced back to a culture that values money more than life, and to institutions that make financial returns to rich people the primary purpose of economic activity. We have allowed the institutional systems by which we now create and allocate money to become the prime operating system of society, and it has run wildly out of control. The system was designed by and for Wall Street interests for the sole purpose of increasing the financial assets of people who have financial assets. Can you imagine? That's what our whole economy is designed for. It makes cheap money readily available to speculators engaged in inflating financial bubbles and financing other predatory money scams, while at the same time making money limited and expensive to those engaged in producing real wealth, pushing them into indebtedness to those who produce nothing at all. It is a sick system. It cannot be fixed. It can and must be replaced by a new financial system designed to serve life. This is an absolutely foundational political message that we must be getting out there. It's not about fixing the existing system. It is about replacing the system. I make the case and spell out the solutions in my new book, Agenda for a New Economy. This is also the theme of the summer 2009 issue of Yes Magazine. Not long ago, we were besieged with stories of how Wall Street's money masters had discovered the secrets of creating limitless wealth through financial innovation free from risk and the burdens of producing anything of real value. It is so unbelievable there were actually academic papers putting forth this thesis that we found the new secret of wealth creation. We don't have to produce anything anymore. We just make money. On an audacious social engineering experiment Corporate interests drove a public policy shift that made finance the leading sector of the U.S. economy and the concentration of private wealth the leading economic priority. They envisioned a world in which the United States would dominate the global economy by specializing in the creation of money and the marketing and consumption of goods produced elsewhere. In this fairy tale fantasy, the rest of the world would forever send us their food, resources, and other products of their labor in return for nothing more than uncollectible IOUs. Wall Street led a political drive to roll back taxes on high incomes, give tax preference to income from financial speculation over income from productive work, cut back social safety nets, suppress wages, privatize public assets, outsource jobs and manufacturing capability, and allow public infrastructure to deteriorate. For a time, their efforts succeeded beyond imagination. Manufacturing in this country fell from 29% of U.S. gross domestic product in 1950 to only 12% in 2005. While financial services grew from 12% of the economy to 20%. From 1980 to 2005, the highest earning 1% of the U.S. population increased its share of taxable income from 9% to 19%, with most of the gain going to the very richest 1%. From being a net exporter, the United States became a net importer, with a persistent annual trade deficit of more than $750 billion, financed by rising foreign debt. One measure of the extent to which we have been living ever further beyond our own means. And all the while, the architects of the restructuring congratulated themselves on their financial genius and rewarded themselves with lavish bonuses, even as they turned us into a national economic basket case and set the stage for global financial collapse. What went wrong? The wealth that Wall Street's self-proclaimed genius thought they were creating was only phantom wealth. Now, as defined by our public culture, wealth and money are largely synonymous. This is a cultural myth that we've all grown up with, the idea that money is wealth. Money and wealth are the same thing. That's what leads us into these incredibly illogical stories about our economy. Conflating these two concepts easily leads us to believe that those who make money are creating wealth, and that finance and housing bubbles are actually engines of wealth creation. Now, you surely recall that as housing prices were inflating, we were regularly told how much wealth or value the rise in market price was creating. And as housing prices deflated, we heard regular reports on how much wealth or value was being destroyed. Curious, isn't it? Absolutely nothing about your house changed except the market price. No difference in space, location, functionality, or state of repair, just a change in the number of dollars the house would fetch in the market. It, of course, is nothing more than a form of inflation. Money increases, real wealth remains exactly the same. And what is money? The vast majority of money in circulation isn't even represented by a number on a piece of paper. It is merely an electronic trace in a computer file. Now, aside from the metal and coins, what we call money has no meaning or existence outside the human mind. Money has value only because, by social convention, we agree to accept it in return for things of real value, our labor, knowledge, and natural resources. Money is an accounting chit created from nothing with a simple accounting entry when a bank issues a loan. As economist John Kenneth Galbraith once famously observed, the process by which money is created is so simple it repels the mind. When you take out a loan from a bank, the bank opens an account in your name and enters the amount of the loan. That becomes a liability on the bank's accounts, offset by a corresponding asset of your promise to repay with interest. Two simple accounting entries, and money magically appears from nowhere. This simple fact is the key to the ability of the institutions of Wall Street and its global counterparts to rule the world. Money, particularly money that is created out of nothing without any contribution to the creation of anything of corresponding value, is phantom wealth. It has no substance or intrinsic utility. So what is real wealth? We might say it is anything that has real value. Land, labor, knowledge, food, education. But most valuable of all are those forms of wealth that are beyond price. Love, a healthy, happy child, a job that provides a sense of self-worth and contribution, membership in a strong, caring community, a healthy, vibrant, natural environment, peace. These are all the forms of real wealth. Are you with me? I did my graduate education in business, studied a lot of business and economics. A lot of people study economics and business in our society, and in those courses, we are taught to treat money and wealth as one and the same. Consequently, we fail to notice that the inflation of financial bubbles, the abuse of power of banks to create money from nothing, corporate asset stripping, bogus bond ratings, and creative accounting, they're all making money for the few while at the same time destroying the real wealth of the many. It's almost an act of self-hypnosis, self-delusion. On the financial side, the system suppressed the wages of the majority of people while using the power of advertising to cajole them to buy more than their wages afforded by accumulating debt for the lack of an adequate wage, debt that they had no means to repay. The borrowers lost their homes and jobs, and the CEOs of the big banks got taxpayer-funded bailouts. Now, there's another reason why we let the Wall Street privateers get away with their scam. It is a simple story, endlessly repeated in our media. We hear it over and over. It's a story that frames our understanding of the economy and economic performance. Economic growth is measured by gross domestic product, GDP, creates wealth to provide material abundance for all, increase human happiness, end poverty, and heal the environment. The faster we consume, the faster the economy grows, and the wealthier we become as the rising tide lifts all boats. A corporation's profits are a measure of its contribution to this wonderful wealth creation process. Is that story familiar? Have you ever suspected there might be just something that's not quite right about it? GDP, of course, actually measures the rate at which the economy is extracting useful resources from nature, running them through the economic system, and disposing of them as toxic waste in our air, water, and soils. You know, I was stunned when I first realized the truth that our current economic policies and institutions are all based on the stupid idea that the faster we convert useful resources to toxic garbage, the richer we are. Now, the only real beneficiaries of this collective madness are a very small group of very rich people who reap the financial gains generated by large corporations positioned to benefit financially from every economic transaction, irrespective of whether that transaction is beneficial or harmful to society. For the rest of us, it is rather like intentionally burning down our house to keep warm and fanning the flames to make it burn faster. As individuals, only the terminally insane would make this foolish error. But as a nation and as a species, we seem not to notice. We have yet to translate our individual intelligence into an effective collective intelligence. This is very key. I've come increasing to realize that most people know the truth in their hearts, but we're afraid to express it because the story we keep hearing in the society is totally contrary. And as long as we keep it secret, we never realize that we're not alone, that it is the public story that is the lie. We cannot resolve the issues of environmental destruction and extreme inequality by treating the symptoms. In most countries, particularly the most profligate, We must reduce overall consumption, and we must redistribute available resources from rich to poor and from destructive to non-destructive essential beneficial uses. This requires turning our present economic system upside down and inside out. It requires ending war and converting to a peace economy, eliminating automobile dependence in favor of compact communities that bring home, work, recreation, shopping, and other aspects of our lives into close proximity. It means curtailing advertising and redirecting those creative and media resources to education, ending financial speculation and redirecting investment to productive, sustainable enterprises devoted to meeting community needs. This list is just a start. Note that none of this, nothing on this list is about sacrifice. It's about sensible priorities and creating a better way of life. Now we hear frequent reference these days to a distinction between the Wall Street economy and the Main Street economy. It is a crucial difference. Wall Street uses money to make money for people who have money without the burden of producing anything of value in return. As we've noted, money diverse from anything of real value is phantom wealth, an illusion, a mirage. Wall Street corporations are all in the same business, creating phantom wealth to create unearned claims against the real wealth of the rest of society for those who least deserve them. Any useful good or service produced as a consequence of this production of phantom wealth is purely incidental. It's actually striking if you read certain opinions in the business press. They almost consider those corporations that actually produce something useful rather than engaging in the secret creation of phantom wealth without producing anything of real value. They're the unproductive ones, the inefficient ones. Because real genius creates wealth from nothing. The Wall Street economy and its institutions function as a doomsday machine. They are corrupt beyond repair. We best use the financial collapse as an opportunity to replace them with a new financial system accountable to Main Street. The Main Street economy is comprised of local businesses and working people engaged in producing real goods and services to meet real needs. It has been battered and tattered by the intrusions of Wall Street corporations. It is, however, in revival in communities all across the nation as they rally to declare their independence from Wall Street and rebuild the community-serving economies they once knew. It is a logical foundation on which to build a new real wealth economy of green jobs, responsible community-oriented businesses, and sound environmental practices. My new book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, spells out a number of the measures we can take to hasten the fall of Wall Street as we build a new economy on the foundation of Main Street. I'll mention just a few of the necessary measures here. Let's start with new performance indicators. I would suggest that the only legitimate function of an economic system is to serve life. You know, this stuff isn't rocket science. At present, however, we assess economic performance solely against financial indicators, particularly gross domestic product or GDP, while disregarding social and environmental consequences. This is not a wise choice. We get what we measure. Phantom wealth and the hundreds of trillions of dollars at the expense of the real wealth of people, community, and nature. We can and we should evaluate economic performance against indicators of what we really want. Healthy children, families, strong communities, and vibrant natural systems. This, of course, would place life values ahead of money values and dramatically reframe both our public and private economic priorities. Excessive corporate profits and exorbitant executive compensation packages come at an extremely high cost to society in the form of public subsidies and uncompensated social and environmental costs. To restore balance, we must eliminate the subsidies and assess compensating fees to recover the public cost of substandard wages and working conditions, expropriated and contaminated environmental resources, and excessive burdens on public services. This will force predatory businesses to close their doors. Responsible businesses will prosper. In alliance with the Federal Reserve, Wall Street players have used a combination of control over the money supply, predatory lending practices, and legal bribery of politicians to suppress wages, dismantle the social safety nets, capture the total benefits of productivity gains for themselves, shift the tax burden from financial speculators to working people, and reduce the poor to debt slavery. To repair the damage and restore the middle class, we must restore progressive tax rates, increase the minimum wage, implement public funding of elections, and a universal single-payer health care. Use the tax code to make financial speculation unprofitable and direct the benefits of productivity gains to the people who produce them. I sense you're with me. Think of this as our equivalent of the biblical Jubilee, a time to forgive the debts that hold the poor in bondage and redistribute real wealth to restore balance to the society. Amen. The time to free the slaves, including the debt slaves. A healthy Main Street economy is a living economy that mimics the dynamics of healthy, locally rooted ecosystems to optimize the health and well-being of people, community, and nature. Local entrepreneurs and business owners need a fair profit to survive, but their primary return comes from having a place of respect in a healthy local community with a healthy natural environment. Relationships are primary in Main Street businesses. Profit and money are means, not ends. Researchers report that a person shopping at a farmer's market has 10 times more conversations than one shopping at a supermarket. I know it's true. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing. Every time I go to our little farmer's market on Bainbridge Island, it's just a flood of conversations with the farmers that grow our food and our neighbors and so forth. So different. Now, as the Wall Street economy disintegrates, the communities with the best prospects are those that are rebuilding local supply chains, supporting local low-input family farms, developing local financial institutions, reclaiming their farms and forest lands, concentrating population in compact communities that minimize automobile use, retrofitting their buildings for energy conservation, and otherwise moving toward local self-reliance in food, energy, and other basic essentials. This is what organizations like the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies and the American Independent Business Alliance are about. Building a people-friendly, earth-friendly, new economy of locally rooted businesses. Yes Magazine, for which I serve as board chair, regularly spotlights the people and the organizations that are engaged in this work. And our summer 2009 issue is on the new economy. Find us online at yesmagazine.org and look for our special section on Path to a New Economy. Now, let's return to that money system. Wall Street bankers have diabolically created a money system designed to crash if the economy does not continuously grow their profits. It's amazing. Once you begin to deconstruct it, that's exactly what it is designed to do. Now, recall my earlier mention of the bookkeeping entry by which a bank creates new money when it issues a loan. That entry creates only the principal of the loan. It does not create the amount of the interest the borrower must also repay. This means that to avoid sending the whole financial system into default and thereby collapse the economy, much like we're now experiencing, the economy must always grow fast enough to generate sufficient demand for new loans to create the money required to make the interest payments on previous loans. It is a type of Ponzi scheme. The consequence is ever-increasing debt, inequality, destruction of the natural environment, and destruction of the social fabric of community. If evil is that which is destructive of life, then our existing money system is profoundly evil. There's an alternative and far less pernicious way to create money. Most people assume that money is created by the federal government. It isn't, but it should be. As new money is required to maintain an adequate and stable money supply, the federal government can and should spend it into existence to fund public infrastructure and meet other public needs. Publicly issued money would increase financial stability while reducing debt, taxes, inequality, and environmental harm. It would also strip Wall Street money changers of much of their power and profits. Are you with me?
Yes.
Regarding failed banks, the federal government should nationalize them, as many economists are recommending.
Yes.
Nationalization will be far cheaper and more effective than simply pouring in new money for management to squander on bonuses, dividends, acquisitions, and office decorations.
Yes.
But here's what's different from the way it's being discussed. Most discussions of the nationalization, the government fix it up, turn it back over to the Wall Street guys to run into the ground again. What we should do, once we've nationalized them, fix them up, is then break them up into their component units, sell off their local bank branches to local Main Street investors to run as community banks and mutual savings and loans. So we begin to get a money system that is accountable to Main Street. So how do we make the changes necessary to turn our economy from service to money to service of life in a world ruled by the agents of money? We, of course, have to work together at many levels to change the rules, create a new money system, and rebuild community. Rebuild community. There's so much we can do and need to do at our community level. Again, so simple. Get to know your neighbors. Shop, work, and invest locally. Engage in conversations with your friends, neighbors, and coworkers that expose the fallacies of cultural stories that hold us captive to institutions that deny our human possibility for peace, justice, and a fulfilling and dignified life for all. Honest conversation may be the ultimate revolutionary act. It is a simple but rarely noted truth that every movement for social transformation begins with a conversation. Take the women's movement as an example. Not long ago, the prevailing cultural story maintained that the key to a woman's happiness is to find the right man, marry him, and devote her life to his service. I assume that's working for all you women out there. Now, any woman for whom that story was not working was at that time supposed to believe that the fault lay within herself. She was not a proper woman. It's good we can laugh about that now, right? But then a few courageous women began getting together in small groups in their living rooms to share their personal stories. And lo and behold, they discovered that the story wasn't working for any of them, and the flaw was not in themselves, but rather in the story. Making this personal story public through an ever-expanding conversation that among hundreds and thousands and millions of women eventually changed the public story, liberated billions of women, and unleashed the power of the feminine as a force for social transformation. The power of conversation. The voluntary simplicity movement was born through a similar process of people coming together to share their stories about what brings them true happiness and sense of fulfillment. And lo and behold, it's not the goods advertised on TV. By sharing life-affirming stories of possibility and working together to restore the essential bonds of community, we humans can bring forth the life-affirming cultures and institutions of a new era. We are privileged to live at the most dangerous but also the most exciting time of creative opportunity in the whole of the human experience. We have the power to turn this world around. Turn it around for ourselves, for our children, and for life's continuing creative journey. We're the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you. You know, for years I've been giving these presentations and people say, well, but isn't it going to have to get worse before it gets better? Well, it got worse, yeah. It's got a lot worse. And, well, it's pretty broken. And I think it's finally getting serious attention. The problem is that too much of the focus is on, you know, what do we do to restore the system to its previous functioning? And this is part of the word we got to get out. You know, this is the time to change the system. Now, on optimism versus pessimism, I often find myself also getting extremely depressed. You know, I think we may be headed into some really bad stuff, and it scares me. But here's the thing I've come to realize. If we assume that change is impossible, we create a self-fulfilling prophecy. I have to believe that change is possible, that we still have time to do it, and do everything in my power to make that a reality. And I presume that that's the way most of you feel, too, or you wouldn't be here. Now, there's a real connection here also to the comment about the food security and you know, the different group, one group on peace activism and another group working on local agriculture. We are fragmented into different movements. We are fragmented by age. I mean, I find it very disturbing you know, most of the groups that I speak to are more or less this age demographic. In fact, there's probably more young people in this group than in many of the groups that I speak to. And that's not saying much. Now, that doesn't mean that the young people are not active. You know, as we were just told, there's a lot of young people working on the agriculture issue. There was just a huge demonstration and rally in Washington, D.C. around the global warming issue that was mainly a youth movement. You know, any of you that remember back in 1999, the major demonstrations against the WTO, that was youth-led movement, and enormously successful, enormously powerful. I don't know quite. I haven't figured out myself why we're so fragmented, but I think we need to start reaching out. And I mean, part of the rebuilding of community is rebuilding the connections between generations. And I'm starting to hear young people say, you know, we need mentors, we need elders. And of course, many of us, you know, here, I'm sure, I'm not the only one who's in what's normally considered retirement age. You know, this is another whole aspect of our culture that we need to totally rethink. You know, it's so amazing that, you know, our society tells us that when we're, after we pass over 65, which of course is just when we're starting to enter into our age of wisdom, and we begin to have a little discretionary time and income and so forth to be activists, we're told we should go away and keep out of things, don't get in the way. We absolutely have to get in the way. But we also need to be reaching out to young people and recognize that we need their energy. They can benefit from our wisdom, experience, and connections. It's part of the rebuilding. But I want to take this opportunity also to mention, you know, we're not only a little narrow here in terms of our age range, we're also pretty white. And I know none of us want it to be that way, but it's another thing that we really need to work on because, you know, this whole empire thing, empire maintains its power by keeping us divided and fragmented. That's the way it works. It's been that way throughout history. And part of what we're realizing now is we need to move, you know, our individual issues are absolutely essential. Peace is important. Food is important. Global warming is important. But what we need to also recognize is that most all of these movements that we are committed to, we're dealing with symptoms of larger systemic and cultural issues. And we need to work on those individual issues, but we also need to come together, to work together on the larger systemic and cultural issues, to change the big story. Now, the first question, the dechartering corporations. You know, obviously the corporations have an awful lot of power, and they basically control the political system and a lot of sway in the judicial system. The issue we absolutely have to deal with. You know, the publicly traded limited liability private benefit corporation that so many of us have focused on is a fundamentally pathological institutional form. I mean, it's very interesting. It's an institutional form that is supposed to serve only its shareholders and only by providing them with money. And of course, we've seen this further perverted because right now our corporations are not even operating in the interest of their shareholders. They are primarily operating in the interest of their top management. They are instruments for theft from the rest of society. And even when they are functioning the way they are sort of legally described and legally sanctioned to function, they fit the psychological profile of a psychopath. You know, a psychopath is a person who's not able to see a situation from any perspective but his or her own, or to serve any interest other than his or her own. You know, we cannot give over our power to psychopaths, artificial or real. Now, you know, I think part of the work before us is not simply to revoke the charters of errant corporations, although that's a very good idea, but it is to fundamentally redefine the corporate charter. There is, you know, you think about it. The corporate charter is issued by a public body and extends certain privileges to a group of investors that other people don't have. I would suggest there is absolutely no legitimate reason to do that other than to serve a public purpose, which suggests that we should be working to create a framework to rewrite every corporate charter. If you're going to have a corporate charter, it must spell out what your public purpose is, and it must be periodically reviewed to determine whether you are in fact serving that purpose. You know, basically, you know, and we also, you know, we need to combine that with a whole series of things, including antitrust to break up the huge concentrations of power. And we have to work with the ownership structure. I mean, one of the things that makes these big corporations so pernicious is that it institutionalizes the most extreme form of absentee ownership and separates the powers of ownership from any other interest. You know, that's why, you know, I advocate breaking these companies up and moving to an economy in which most all our enterprises are owned by people that have a real responsible stake in them. They may be workers, they may be community members, but it's not just, you know, a number in a 401k. It is your business that you're engaged with. You know, the kinds of things that we're talking about here in terms of fundamentally restructuring corporations, you know, changing the way we create money, relocalizing the whole banking system. These are kinds of things that, for the most part, have not been in the public conversation beyond very narrow groups of people. Now, practically, if you look at the situation that President Obama is in, he first of all faces a huge crisis. I mean, everything's crashing down and everybody's looking to him to do something to save our jobs. So he is very constrained by that reality. But he's also constrained by the reality that it's politically totally infeasible for him to come forward and make suggestions or push for changes that absolutely nobody understands. I mean, even if he understands them, I don't know whether he grasps these issues or not. But, you know, he's told us, if you want me to do something, you have to make me do it. Now, he's not being flip about that. I mean, that's the political reality. He's got these enormous political pressures on him. He's brought in a lot of people in the administration who come right out of Wall Street. They are totally aligned with Wall Street interests because he had to have people who understand Wall Street, whether he liked it or not. Now, all this means we've got a lot of work to do because we've got to get the new story out there. Now, here, our friend right here is working with the American Monetary Institute, which is one of the lead institutions on changing the money system so that we use government-issued money. You know, we need to take his story. We need to take that work, and we need to get it out there in a much broader, much larger way. But this, you know, this is where we're at. We don't have much time, but there is an openness for this conversation. You know, people, your neighbors, your church members, and so forth. They're, everybody's eager to try to understand what's going on and what can we do about it. So buy a copy of my book and organize a discussion group. Okay, the corporation versus the partnership. You know, I don't have all the answers on exactly what are the exact forms of enterprise. I know the basic framework. We need any enterprise that has special privileges also needs to have special responsibilities, and that needs to be built legally in. We want to move toward toward rooted ownership, responsible ownership, rather than absentee ownership. So what are all the ways that we can do that? Partnerships can be equally pernicious to a corporation, but it's extremely difficult to amass anywhere near the same amount of financial resources in a partnership that one can amass in a publicly traded corporation. So that's a start toward improvement. In terms of the issue of one of the most fundamental market principles, the speaker mentioned internalizing externalities. If you're trashing the environment, whatever, you should pay a fee to make up the difference, because all the, by fundamental market principles that I studied in economics, for the market to allocate efficiently, costs need to be internalized. Now, as you suggested, that frame gives a particular advantage to the rich, because if you can afford it, you can do anything you want. Well, that's the other piece of this, of course. So, I talked about progressive tax system. We absolutely have to redistribute wealth in society. This is another one of the false stories. The idea that, if you're concerned about poverty, then, let's just have economic growth and we'll bring up the bottom. Don't worry about those people up there that that control the banks and the billionaires. They're not the problem. But of course they are, because we live in a finite world, and this is just an absolute foundational reality. We used to have a lot of extra resources. We don't have any extra resources anymore. So it is about how are they distributed. And we absolutely must face up to, if we're going to deal with poverty, we have to deal with equity. And the only way to get equity is through redistribution. I've mentioned various forms of progressive tax system. And of course, to me, the estate tax is extremely important. This really is our equivalent of the biblical jubilee, that at least at the end of every generation, you rebalance. No lucky sperm syndrome here.